In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Thursday, April 29th, 2010 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We thank you for listening. In hour number two of our program today, we will dig into personnel payment. What do you make in the military and how might that change in 2011 thanks to the fiscal year 2011 budget request, the defense authorization request? You'll hear from William Carr, Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Military Personnel Policy, among others. Later on in hour number two, Max Kakis at the Web Managers Conference earlier this week, hosted by the General Services Administration. We'll dig into that for you. But we start with iPhone apps. Your agency is working on ways to get information out to citizens more easily, more freely, more transparently. And some of the ways that some agencies are doing that are through creating iPhone apps and other apps for smartphones. One person thinking about this and writing about it is Sharon Maklis of Computer World. Sharon's my guest to talk about this subject for a particular reason. Sharon, welcome to the program. Nice to have you on today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
The impetus for this was a piece that you wrote on your blog, which we'll link up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, with the headline, "It's Time to End Government-Funded iPhone Apps." And that caught my attention because, with the emphasis in Washington, especially on open government and transparency and so on, some of the things that you wrote in here I thought were really interesting, and I'm looking forward to exploring them with you. You start out by talking about a Freedom of Information Act request from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They put this request into NASA that kind of got the ball rolling, at least in your mind. Talk about the scene that was set here by this FOIA request.
Yeah, this is the iPhone Developer Program License Agreement. So it's, if you want to develop for the iPhone, you need to sign this agreement with Apple. And they have some rather stringent controls on what people can do. For example, this agreement actually prohibits public statements about the agreement itself, which does not seem to be something that a public agency should have to agree to. They also prohibit the distribution of the software any place except the Apple App Store for the iPhone, which, if taxpayer money is going to create a piece of software, it shouldn't be limited to one company's distribution arrangement. I mean, as a practical matter, there may be no other way to do it, but I don't think they should be codifying that into the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Apple has the right to say yes or no for something going into the store. They could say no at any time, and, you know, tens of thousands of dollars of development work can be down the drain. Now, the odds of them doing that obviously are small, but that's what's in the contract.
Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of things being in this deal that are run kind of contrary to the whole point of government information and the ability of the government to serve the citizens. Now, one thing that is different about this than some of the other social networking agreements that we've seen is we don't have a sense yet, and we're going to be reaching out to the Office of Management and Budget and GSA to find out more about this. But GSA negotiated a terms of service agreements with a whole host of Web 2.0 providers so that agencies could, if they chose, just adopt these tools. We don't get a sense from what we've seen in the media that Apple has a tendency to be interested in those kinds of negotiations, do we?
Is a closed hardware and software environment. I mean, that and it works to their advantage in a number of ways, in not economically, but I mean just in terms of the actual hardware and software, because they have control over the whole experience. Their argument would be that it's a better experience than having open hardware attachments, open software, and so on. The open source movement would disagree, but this particular agreement was just kind of the last straw for me, because there's a whole separate issue about developing for the iPhone, which means that in order to take advantage of an iPhone application, you actually have to own Apple hardware. It's a little bit different than developing an application for the web. You know, anyone who doesn't have web access can go to the public library and use it. You're not locked into one provider. With an iPhone, you need to buy Apple hardware and you know, pay a monthly fee to AT&T. And if the government is choosing to develop for the iPhone, they're helping to pick a winner into what's very competitive mobile space right now. And I'm not really sure that should be what they're doing.
I guess the opposite of that is that if the opportunity exists to get this information out, at least to some people's better than none, even though you have the issue of people with iPhones being able to access the information, people with WebOS phones, the Palm OS, or the Android or whatever, Windows Mobile for all five people that have that like me, those folks don't have the access to the information, but at least some people are getting it rather than nobody.
I mean, that is one argument, but here's an example of a local application that I had a problem with. The city of Boston spent roughly $25,000 developing an iPhone application allowing some citizens to better report problems in the city. So they could, like, snap a picture of graffiti or snap a picture of a pothole, and they had this extra avenue to report problems to the city. Now, that's great on the one hand if you're a citizen who happens to have an iPhone anyway. But if the city of Boston was saying, we'll allow you to have special access to report problems, however, you need to buy hardware for X number of hundreds of dollars and you need to pay a monthly fee of X number of dollars a month in order to have the special access to report your problems, people would be up in arms. But in effect, that's what this is.
All right. You write in this piece, I'm all in favor of open government and leveraging technology to improve access to government, and iPhone apps can help a select group of citizens better communicate with their government. That sounds like a pretty noble goal when you look at it on the surface.
Okay, here's what I think government should be doing. Government should be making its data and its information developer-friendly. That's actually what the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is doing. They have an open data initiative, and it's really interesting. The Mass Bay Transit Authority, the public transit system here, actually is encouraging outside developers at MIT and elsewhere to mash up the data that they have. And so you've got applications that are being developed not by the government, but by independent people that allow people to see where their bus is and how long it's going to take before it comes to the next stop. I mean, this is great, but I think the government's role is to create the information and present it in an extremely developer-friendly way and then let the developer community have at it. I mean, that's one of the things that's made Twitter so popular. It's not just the service itself, but it's the whole ecosystem of applications around Twitter, and that's because Twitter makes the data streams and the application programming interfaces available to the developer community. That's what works.
Sharon Macklis is online managing editor at Computer World. Her piece is called It's Time to End Government-Funded iPhone Apps, and we'll have it posted up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon so you can take a look at it. The difference between iPhone apps that are proprietary for the iPhone and web apps. Talk about the limitations or advantage, you know, the advantages of doing it one way over the other.
Well, you've got a web application where anyone with a computer system and a browser can access the information. And that's been very effective to reach a large number of people. As I said, people who don't have in-home access often have at-work access or can get to a public library or an internet cafe or whatever and get that. Now, a lot of smartphones also have web access. So it's not that if you don't do an application specific to a specific mobile platform like an iPhone or a BlackBerry or an Android, that people can't have mobile access to the data. That's kind of a fallacy. But an application for a specific platform is a piece of software running on the application itself. I'm sorry, a piece of software running on the mobile device itself. And those are platform-specific. Now, different platforms have different development tools. For example, WebOS, you mentioned Palm, is pretty open. Android is pretty open. Apple, the iPhone, is rather closed.
Is there any danger here, you think, of maybe some folks kind of getting too enamored with the idea of the iPhone as shiny toy, and this is so cool and hip, and we want to be cool and hip, and so we'll look like we're involved with this and maybe not thinking about some of the things that you're talking about in your piece?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, you know, some of the people who are making these decisions probably have iPhones and are experiencing the applications and find them extremely useful. And I'm not arguing that they're not useful. They definitely are. But the question is, in an era of limited resources, where do you put them? I don't think you put them to benefit one class of people requiring monthly fees and a fairly large hardware expenditure over others. And but yes, I mean, it certainly is, you know, the cachet of the iPhone is rather high. I mean, you could say the same thing about Facebook and Twitter. The difference there is the end user is not required to pay anything in order to use those services, and I consider that a huge difference.
Sharon Maclis of Computer World's my guest on In Depth with Frances Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Her piece will be linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
Officials from the Department of Treasury, the Federal Reserve System, and the Secret Service have unveiled the new design for the American $100 note, complete with advanced technology to combat counterfeiting. Among new security features in the redesigned note are a 3D security ribbon and the so-called bell in the inkwell. The blue ribbon on the front of the bill contains images of bells and the number 100 that move and change as you tilt the note. The bell on the inkwell changes color from copper to green when the note is tilted, an effect that makes it seem to appear and disappear within a copper inkwell. The new security features come after more than a decade of research. The new note will be issued on February 10th. Of 2011.
General Dynamics Information Technology, delivering the strength of technology to achieve mission success. General Dynamics IT. Visit GDIT.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Coach Lynn. You know, we all live in our own little worlds, but have you ever wondered what goes on in the mind of a person with autism? We have a rare view about autism and some of the wonderful therapies available. Tune in this Saturday right here at Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and 820 AM, 11 to 12. Prosper.
Across government, federal IT managers are contending with the OMB directive to consolidate data centers. Are you on the right path? Join leading experts from government and industry as they chart a practical roadmap to OMB compliance at the GTSI Technology Leadership Series, May 12th at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. Attend and receive a free copy of their new federal IT survey on virtualization. To register, visit gtsi.com/TLS. GTSI, one mission, yours.
Hey there, I'm Christopher Dorvec. Here's what we're working on for this afternoon's Daily Debrief. How do you make government cool again? Well, the Federal CIO Council has been asking that question and come up with some ideas, and we'll talk to them about it. And yes, ants ruin a picnic, but they just might make your agency more cyber secure. Digital ants, anyway. We'll talk to the cybersecurity scientist from one of the Energy Department's national labs. All that and much more this afternoon, 3 to 7 on the Daily Debrief with Chris Dorvec and Amy Morris, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, is the home of the Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Jane Norris. Weekday mornings from 6 to 10, Tom and Jane navigate the world of the RFIs, RFPs, circulars, executive orders, and regulations for you, the federal manager and contractor, and deliver news, perspective, and analysis in plain language to make your agency and company more efficient. Tom and Jane speak to newsmakers and analysts live to get to the details on the latest mission-critical news and information. The Federal Drive is federal news from the inside up. The Federal Drive with Tom Temin and Jane Norris. Weekday mornings from 6 to 10 only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Your source for federal news now.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest is the online managing editor at Computer World, Sharon Maclis, and we're talking about her piece on her blog, which we'll link up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, called It's Time to End Government-Funded iPhone Apps. And you talk in your piece about some of the things that, some of the reasons why you believe that this is a good idea. And I encourage everyone to go and read that when I post it up, put a link up to it later today. But you've obviously been paying attention to this and thinking about this for a while. Are there some success stories out there where you think that governments are providing their information the right way and directing their efforts the right way to give us some success story ideas?
Yes, yeah, some state governments have very interesting programs. You know, the difference right now between state governments and the federal Open Government Initiative is that some of the state programs are specifically targeting developers and showing them what data is available for them in their applications. If you look at the federal pages, there just seems to be a big mix of data for end users on the web and stuff you can download for your own apps. But I think the programs that specifically target developers and show them what data is available in what format and how to use it are working. For example, again, in the Boston area, the MBTA, the Transit Authority, they are actually having a challenge. They actually offer cash prize for the best app that's developed. There was a story in the local paper, the Boston Globe, about a software engineer who in one afternoon with $350 worth of materials actually built an LED sign at one of the local bus stops so you could see where your bus was and when it would be expected to arrive at the stop. I mean, I think that's great. Instead of the government actually doing that, the government created the conditions for people with the talent and expertise to do it.
That's the kind of thing that Vivek Kundra talks about when he gives speeches about government data and so on. He cites a company that uses data from the FAA about on-time airplane flight arrivals, providing that service through a web-based application. Sounds to me like that's the direction you're headed in, especially given what we talked about web apps. What are some of the things that you'd like to see governments do? What is it that the government is providing there that gives these developers the information, the back-end stuff that they need to be able to develop these things?
You want to have one central place where a developer can go and find all the data that's available just for applications and mashups, and you want to tell them what format it's in, and you want to explain to them how it's going to be available, and then let them go at it. I mean, I could envision, like, the National Park Service, for example, they have their own web app, Find a Park, links to reservations, and that's really great. But if you envision one step further for that and say, okay, have let someone develop a mobile app that would allow people to see what parks are nearby if they're on vacation, mm-hmm. and immediately have that pull up, so you add the GPS geolocation to that service. But if they were able to make the information available, then the developers could take it from there. I'm not really sure the Park Service right now has the resources to develop that kind of application for half a dozen different platforms.
My guest is Sharon Maclis of Computer World, the online managing editor there. Her piece is called It's Time to End Government-Funded iPhone Apps, giving you some ideas about how other governments are using data and providing it to citizens to be able to spread it around. We'll wrap up our conversation in just a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and we will take you to the GSA's Web Managers Conference in about 15 minutes from now on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Chris Maurer, CNBC Business Radio. Stocks are sharply higher. The Dow's up 137 points. The Nasdaq higher by 36. Oil prices are up $2 to above $85 a barrel. That's despite reports of increasing domestic crude inventories. Analysts say traders are focusing more on signs of an improving economy and the increased demand for fuel that comes with it. The Labor Department says new claims for jobless benefits fell 11,000 to 448,000 last week. The new total is slightly more than economists had been expecting. The state with the largest decline is New York, with a drop of 21,000. That's mostly because of fewer layoffs in the service and transportation industry. And Toyota says it's selling its recalled 2010 Lexus GX460 again. The Japanese automaker has made the software fix to repair the vehicle stability control system available to its dealerships. Chris Maurer, CNBC Business Radio.
Ford and Lincoln Mercury Service presents Mike Rowe with the secret to unlocking the space-time continuum.
Well, look, I really just wanted to talk about being in four places at one time.
Really? How do you do it?
Well, it's simple. You go to the dealership service department. You got a car, right?
Sure.
When your car needs something, what are you going to do? Go to a tire store, a brake place, a fast lube shop, a discount store? See, to me, that's all complicated. Your car needs something, you go to a Ford or Lincoln Mercury dealership for service, because they can do it all right there. Tires, brakes, oil changes, whatever you need, all in one place.
Right. Like the Works Fuel Saver Package, a Motocraft synthetic blend oil and filter change, tire rotation, and more. All for just $29.95 or less after $10 rebate at your Ford and Lincoln Mercury dealer.
Expertise, value, and convenience. It's no secret. Ford and Lincoln Mercury Service.
Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. See participating dealership or visit genuineservice.com for mailing rebate form and details through 52910.
We'll just keep this between us, huh?
You wouldn't drive your kids in the car without them wearing their seatbelts. So why would you leave them unprotected once you're gone? At Zelle Law, we help protect your assets for your heirs and provide the latest techniques designed to maximize your wealth. To learn more, call 571-203-9355 or visit us on the web at zellelaw.com. You can also join me, Wayne Zell, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. for Blueprint for Wealth right here on Federal News Radio.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit. Presented by NITP has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Profile America, Thursday, April 29th. You may know that Hoboken, New Jersey is the hometown of Frank Sinatra, but you probably don't know that it's also the home of Gideon Sundbach, who received a patent on this date in 1913 for something we all use every day. He called it the separable fastener, but it was soon named the zipper. For years, they were used just on rubber boots. But designer Elsa Schiaparelli used them on her 1930 fashions, and today they are universal. Along with Velcro, zippers are a vital part of the apparel industry. Across the U.S., there are 153,000 clothing stores, and they sell $123 billion worth of women's, men's, and children's clothing each year. Profile America is completing its 13th year as a public service of the U.S. Census Bureau.
The case involves stealing more than $300,000 from banks and brokerage firms. Special Agent Mike Petronella at the FBI's New York office says there was a money mule.
Money was wired into the personal account, and then it would be withdrawn by the money mule in cash, basically give it to our gentleman that we ended up arresting, and then that gentleman would use Western Union to actually send the money overseas.
Petronella says the money mule played a key role.
The individual that we're discussing here, he was a recruiter, a mid-level money mule recruiter, so he would be in contact with the guy in a foreign country. He would find then people here in the United States who could take the money into their own bank accounts.
Hacking into victim banks and brokers was done from overseas. One guy on the inside became a source for the FBI.
We approached him to interview him on his activity, and he basically said, yeah, I'm involved in this. I know it's bad. I'm willing to help you out any way I can.
One subject who hacked and moved money around admitted guilt and was sentenced to prison for 3 years and a month. I'm Neil Schiff of the FBI on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The American Council for Technology is celebrating 30 years of collaboration between government and industry. The upcoming Management of Change Conference features speakers, workshops, best practices, and networking opportunities, all focusing on the government's IT strategic agenda. Building on the success of the past 30 years of collaboration, this conference is a must-attend for government and industry IT leaders. Mark your calendar for May 23rd through the 25th at the Lowe's Philadelphia Hotel. For more information or to register, go to actgov.org/MOC2010. Register today.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Happy to have on the program today Sharon Maclis, online managing editor at Computer World, and blog post which is titled, It's Time to End Government-Funded iPhone Apps. And we're talking about not just the idea of the iPhone app, Sharon, that I think is important here, but the idea of overall openness and transparency in government. And I encourage anybody interested in those subjects to go to federalnewsradio.com. I'll have it actually posted up by the 2 o'clock hour here on the East Coast that you can check that out and see what Sharon is writing about. In the last segment, you and I were talking about ways that agencies at all levels of the government are making information available and letting the developers do the work. You mentioned one thing that I thought was particularly interesting, and that's creating one source of information where developers can go and get it and know that it is all same format, that they're going to be able to work with it and all that kind of thing. The idea that some agencies have struggled with is how good is the data that they're putting up there, and is the concern more about getting data put up by a certain deadline or put up with a certain level of quality? Talk about what you're thinking about the importance of the quality of the data that goes up when it comes to then developers coming in on the back end and being able to use it to do something constructive.
Yeah, and there are two kinds of data that we're talking about as well. I mean, some of the data, for example, how government spends its money or campaign finance, things like that. I mean, that's for government openness and helping citizens understand how their money is being spent. And a web application just in your browser on your computer, I think, would be fine for that. Then there's data that would be useful for mashups and mobile applications and things like that. And that needs to be someplace, in my opinion, separate so that developers know this is where we go if we want to play with the data and create applications. Massachusetts has a place just for that. I know California has a place just for that. And if the government wants to try to encourage developers to work with the data, they need to do that, I think, as well, instead of mixing the two types of information releases together. But quality of information is really critical, as well as timely information if you're talking about something that's real-time, near real-time. How often would you use Google Maps if it kept giving you bad information about where things were located or showing you three-year-old businesses that aren't there anymore? So starting slowly for this kind of data but making sure that you get it right is better than just releasing a lot of stuff that ends up not being useful.
Mm-hmm. The example of that I always go back to is the recovery.gov website with all the data that was put up there about where the recovery money was being spent. And Ed DeSev, the federal official in charge of that website, said there are going to be problems with this data. We want to get it out there as quickly as possible. He warned everybody very eloquently, I thought, ahead of time, but it doesn't look like a lot of people heard those warnings, because before we knew it, this whole effort was being kind of ridiculed in some of the media because this information was exactly what he said it was going to be. It was not 100% pure, and it needed to be massaged, and it needed to be kind of proofread, if you will. And I think since then we've seen some agencies, at least, that are a little bit hesitant to provide that information. Have you seen that kind of thing at the state and local level when you're looking at these kinds of things?
I mean, and any huge amount of data is going to have issues in it, and people need to understand that. And I think there's a difference between when you're talking about journalists and public advocacy groups who work with data sets on a regular basis and understand the limitations, and then the general public, where you say, you know, here it is, and the assumption is, well, this is for my government, this is accurate, and that's not necessarily true. So in the case of developers, I mean, I don't honestly think you should be releasing data for public-facing application development. That is not really good, because then you're asking people to waste a lot of time and effort on something like that. However, you could release it in beta and saying, you know, that the data isn't accurate yet, but here's the format that it's going to be like if you want to play with it. And developers are very comfortable with that, because that's what they do with their own development workflow.